You're listening to Taking Stock with Kathleen Hayes and Pim Fox on Bloomberg Radio.
Should you buy technology stocks? And if so, what kinds of technology stocks should be in your portfolio? Well, that's why we asked David Garrity to join us. He is the principal for GVA Research. He joins us here in the studio. David, thank you for coming in today.
Pim, my pleasure. Thank you.
I was interested in your note talking about maybe a change in where people want to allocate their capital next year, away from big growth stories such as Facebook, and maybe focus more on technology companies that are offering dividends, like a Microsoft. Expand a little bit on that strategy.
Certainly. I mean, if we look at the monetary policy context, we're moving into an environment right now where asset allocation is going to start to matter more. And when we were in a low interest rate environment, obviously companies that had high growth that didn't necessarily offer dividends or near-term cash flows that had high duration values in a fixed income sense obviously rose in terms of valuations. Now that we actually have interest rates on a near-term basis and potentially are looking at an increase in capital costs going forward, decisions around sort of do you want to be high duration or low duration in terms of looking at a sector, we start to think that lower duration names that offer a total return, such as a dividend, may make more sense. Granted, when you're looking at technology, you're looking at secular growth themes. Arguably, if you were a venture capital investor, you might be investing with a 7 to a 10 year horizon. Obviously, though, looking in public markets, where we're now in a situation where investors are going to start to be able to consider other asset classes apart from equities, if you're going to be involved in technology, you probably need to be looking at companies that offer not only good secular growth, but also current income, a total return.
Well, and in fact, more broadly, anybody right now with interest rates, yields still so low on many good old safe bonds, it's another reason to, you know, buy stocks that behave like bonds. But when it comes to Microsoft, Dave, one thing that stands out to me about you is that a few years back, when, you know, I think back when I first started doing a radio show here, you were a fan of Microsoft at a time when people were, before everyone kind of jumped on the Microsoft bandwagon, Dave Garrity saw the value in Microsoft. You saw it in the business model. You saw it in the things we were doing. Do you still see those secular strengths in Microsoft?
Yes. I mean, we're still in a situation now where, you know, granted the CEO, Satya Nadella, you know, has now had the CEO role for over a year. But nevertheless, the changes that he's been putting in place in terms of redefining the company, reorienting it more towards the cloud, more towards the buildup of their own cloud services, Azure. Microsoft, after Amazon's and Amazon's Web Services business, has the second largest cloud facility that's being offered. And to the extent that you're seeing more business go over towards the cloud, you're seeing growth rates there of over 100% year over year. Microsoft is leading in that. At least you find in the case of looking with Microsoft is that you not only have their existing historically strong base in terms of installed software, but you find them now at least reorienting the company in such a way as to participate in the structural changes taking place in technology, the move towards the cloud. You also see the company itself being willing to experiment more in trying to show how various types of hardware and software can be better integrated. You've seen some success with their Surface tablet. Granted, you wouldn't necessarily want to be recommending a hardware play specifically, but Microsoft as a company is becoming somewhat on the margin more innovative, and they're certainly taking costs out, and certainly in the process creating value for shareholders. If we look back over the last 2 years, the stock has gone from roughly about the mid-30s up to the mid-50s, and we still think that there's potential return for investors from here.
David Garrity, will Uber go public in 2016?
Uber will go public, but I would argue that Uber will go public at a lower valuation. And, I mean, currently we've had capital rounds from Uber, which have been valuing the company, you know, north of $50 billion. At the same time, you've been having developments taking place in terms of Uber's input markets, where you're starting to see decisions being made on a local basis, whether you look at California or whether you look at Seattle, where their associates, who are not employees, are being allowed to unionize. And also at the same time, Uber, as an algorithm that's able to manage a fleet of vehicles and their associated drivers, is not something that's necessarily in and of itself proprietary. We've seen a number of other competitors coming out, Lyft, as well as we could go through and name many, many others, not just here domestically, but also overseas. And we think from that standpoint, you know, Uber, probably better serves their own interests to the extent that they remain private for longer. I know that there's been some speculation that you've seen companies like JP Morgan who've been sort of getting closer to Uber and the idea of trying to position themselves for some sort of a transaction. You've certainly seen other firms, I think, such as a Goldman Sachs, invest in earlier rounds, albeit when valuations were more reasonable, I think sub $20 billion. So certainly, you know, there's an interest on the part of Wall Street in the value creation of this. But my view is that the public market conditions for Uber are going to be probably far more challenging in 2016.
Hey, Dave, the Fed's barely moved. Bond market's back to where it was before it moved. Janet Yellen made it very clear they're not going to reduce their balance sheet. And you know, that's a little sounds technical to some people. Basically, still a very accommodative policy. Is it too early to say, is the flow of money, is the spigot starting to just squeeze off a bit so that maybe all that money that was floating some of these companies is going to be less readily available?
Well, I mean, the view is if we look at sort of credit spreads, now granted, if you're looking at the junk bond market, I mean, not everybody wants to run in and buy oil company related high yield credit. But arguably to the extent that spreads have widened out and perhaps valuations have become somewhat more reasonable, to the extent that you at least start to move towards an environment where short-term interest rates go from being, you know, 25% perhaps up to, if we get four increases of 25, we're going to up to 100 or full percentage point short-term, you know, arguably you start to see, hopefully in the context of a non-recessionary economy, a positively sloped yield curve, which may end up giving us 30-year rates that are somewhere, you know, more towards 4, which I think is where the trend is, that in terms of what the Fed governors would like to see over time. In that environment, arguably, we had been in a situation for the last 7 years where people were basically being forced to take risk by the Fed. Now we're in a situation where we're moving towards a monetary policy regime where that's no longer going to be on the case. So even though we look at current market conditions and we say, 25 basis points, what's the big deal? We at least know we're moving in a direction where asset allocation is going to matter more. And from that standpoint, people, if they have the decision to say, you know, do you want to spend $25,000 to seed a friend's startup company, or do you want to put this into, you know, some sort of fund where you're earning a 4% return, people may sort of say, yeah, I at least can make choices now.
Can I interest you in a technology stock that is down about 1% so far this year, has an estimated price-to-earnings ratio of about 11. Overall market, I think, is around 18. So this is 11, and it pays a 1.9% dividend. And, oh, yes, it just happens to be worth about $600 billion.
Well, yeah, I mean, Apple,
yes.
Our closet money market fund. But we would argue that in the case of Apple, at least we're in a situation here where the smartphone market continues to grow at probably about a 10% annual rate. Apple's share of that market is stable, if not rising, because of their greater penetration in China. Now, granted, China does represent an economic risk, but there seems to be a preference still in China towards the consumption of Apple products. So we don't think that the game is over there entirely. And probably what we're seeing now is a bit of a lull with the expectation that when we get the iPhone 7, which if they follow their historic timeline would be coming out towards the end of September of 2016, you probably would see the stock rally going into the back half of 2016. Okay. So even though Apple may have had a disappointing 2015, certainly a name to consider, and certainly a name that in an environment that arguably may be somewhat choppy offers better relative value.
Dave Garrity, thank you so very much for joining us from GVA Research. I think that's a powerful recommendation when someone actually owns the stocks they're positive on. And of course, Dave has ownership in Apple and Microsoft, which he's discussed today.